Right. So when someone has the Excalibur sword, right, and it's in a museum, it's like this sword was owned by Prince Egypt of the second Tuesday of last Wednesday, you know, whatever. It's got a whole history. And now as artists, we can have a history of all of our work, which allows us to, well, I mean, to command a little bit more value from it, and allows people who are buying it to add value and trade it.
Hey, welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Raymond Hatfield, and each week I interview one of the world's most interesting photographers to learn what it really takes to capture beautiful images so that you can start to do the same. In today's Rewind episode, we are chatting with fine art landscape photographer Jason Matias about learning what to say with your images. But first, the Beginner Photography Podcast is brought to you by CloudSpot. Sell your images through print, product, and of course, digitals. Set up a storefront in minutes and start earning more money with each gallery. You can grab your free forever account over at deliverphotos.com and only upgrade when you are ready. Now, in today's episode with Jason, you're going to learn three things. The first is the value of comfortable isolation, how cultivating a personal connection with, you know, either your subject or your theme can lead to a really unique body of work. And embracing the learning process. You know, it's normal to struggle with the technical aspects of photography, but Jason's going to share some tips on how he kept at it and then eventually broke through. And lastly, you're going to learn the power of storytelling. Jason shares how he uses photography as a way to tell stories, which is what differentiates fine art from mere snapshots. So there's a ton to learn here. So buckle up. With that, let's go ahead and get on into today's interview with Jason Matias. Jason, my first question for you is that I know that you didn't start with photography at a young age, quote unquote, like many photographers claim that they do. So can you tell me about when you knew that photography was going to play an important role in your life?
When I couldn't get a job. That's when it became really important. No, so I was in the military and I was stationed in North Pole, Alaska. And that's when I started photography. There was a few things going into it. There was, I couldn't go home, which I'm thankful that I didn't go home for years after joining the military. And that shaped me in a way, but I couldn't go home and I wanted to share some stuff with my family. And then I also, two more things. I was doing a lot of adventure stuff, right? I'm like 19, 20, 21, my first military station, and nobody would believe the things that I was telling them, like finding wolves and being stalked and walking up to bears and stuff like that. People just didn't believe that. So
walking up to bears, you walked up to bears.
Yeah, I have kayaked straight up to the nose of a bear.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. While he was fishing. Actually, that wasn't my choice. So there was a two-person kayak, and I don't know what she was thinking in the front, but it was just like a group thing, right? So I got placed with this random woman, and she just kept going in Valdez. And I was like, what the shit? I'm trying to pedal back, but trying not to make too much ruffle because the bear was very interested in what it was doing. But anyway, so that, and then cameras were becoming accessible, and I had left art in like seventh grade. Like I was convinced by my betters that art was no future and I needed to focus on the real things like getting a job and stuff like that. And I was very interested in physics and I wanted to be an Air Force pilot. So it felt easy to let go of this thing that didn't have a future. But then cameras became accessible and I could afford one. And I started taking pictures. And what happened, what I started doing is I had an affinity for panoramic images. And I was shooting with a little point and shoot, like this big, and it cost too much money because they were still expensive back in 2006. And I was doing the like multiple captures and then stitching them together. And then people would be like, you could sell this. Like, this is so good. Right. And that was just motivation to keep going. And, you know, I'm not really good at short answers, but 2011 rolls up. I get out of the military. I finish my bachelor's in 2012 and I start my master's. And during that time, I was getting more serious about photography. Like we talked a little bit earlier about reaching the edge of what I could do with a compact camera. And then finding out that I couldn't get a freaking job. So the only money I was making was money that I was earning with my camera selling art because I wanted to pay for more camera gear. And it was like, well, how do I scale this? Which I didn't use those words in my head back then because I didn't understand business, but it was like, this makes money. How do I make more money? So I have a master's degree in organizational leadership, which is like an MBA plus a psychology degree. And I have never had a job after getting out of the military. because I just won't get hired. I don't understand. I don't care anymore. But I at the time, it was really, really stressful. So when I started making money with photography, it started becoming like, this is the thing I have to do. And then it went from there.
So military experience, master's degree, and you couldn't get a job. Like,
I have a PMP too.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what that is. That sounds impressive. Like, where are these places where you're trying to get a job? I mean, were you looking for like entry level jobs? You think you were trying to shoot above what do you think the issue was?
Take everything off my resume and apply for dishwasher jobs and not get them.
Really?
Yeah. So, but my goal was to get, I wanted to be a consultant because my mentality was I always wanted to be an engineer, but then the Air Force wouldn't pay for it, which is a whole nother story. And so, because I always wanted to work on one project and then leave it and then work on something new because I didn't want to be stuck doing the same thing over and over. So with this MSOL degree, I was very qualified to be a consultant where I could work on change management for a company, then go to the next one. So I wanted to get into a consulting agency. And I've applied for the gamut of things, everything from being a dishwasher to major consulting firms all over the country. And it's just nothing.
And so the only person is
a project management certificate. And that was another 2-year course I did. And I still couldn't get a job.
Jeez. So the only person calling your name was your camera. Tell me what those days were like, because you said like 2006, you're in Alaska, you're taking photos, you enjoy it. 2011 comes around. Between those years, you continued photography, you continued your focus and taking photos. Is that right?
It was always a side gig or I think I did it as I did other stuff. I was, you know, hiking and backcountry stuff. And I was more interested in putting myself in dangerous situations than I was making pictures. Right. And the camera just came along to prove it. And in between those, so after Alaska, I did a little bit of time in Afghanistan and then I went to Nevada and everything sort of backed down when I went to Nevada, cause it's not a very pretty place. So it was slow. I didn't really dive in until I got out of the military. I moved myself to Hawaii, and that's where I started really trying to take a better image, because I am competitive. I am competitive at heart. So I would go to the beach or wherever there was to take a photo, and I would never or rarely be the only person there. So I'm standing there almost shoulder to shoulder with photographers going down the beach. And I'm standing there saying, how can I make something different? How can I do something different and better, right? How can I do that? And that was the drive to start creating, at the time, landscape photography that was standout. And it took a while. It, you know, didn't happen right away. But I think the biggest key to creating that aesthetic that I've come up with now and creating those images that we're not, is throwing everything away. Like I would go and I would take photos and then I'd be like, this is not special. There's nothing different about it. And then I just wouldn't look at them anymore. And in the beginning I was throwing things away. Like I would delete the images, which I totally regret now. 100%. I was just making it by and hard drives were super expensive. And I just didn't understand the value of saving all of those images, especially the raws. So I was literally throwing them away. It's like, this wasn't any good, you know, go away. And today it's kind of the same way. I will go to a place and if I'm with other people, they will take dozens or hundreds of photos and I'll take 20 because I'm only looking for a specific thing. And I think that focus is what helped me become a better photographer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you. So when you moved out to Hawaii, you had bought the DSLR by that point? Yeah.
No, I bought it when I was in Hawaii.
Okay. So when you made that jump from compact camera to DSLR, what was that like? Like from a technical standpoint, what was different? What was more difficult about photography for you? Hey, Hey, Raymond here. If you're sometimes baffled by which camera settings to use, then I've got just the thing for you. My free guide, Picture Perfect Camera Settings. It's a fantastic starting point for anybody eager to understand the basics of camera settings in various shooting scenarios. And it's tailored to beginners who want to get out of auto mode, providing clear, easy-to-follow suggestions on where to start with your settings. So whether you're capturing a stunning landscape or a family portrait, Picture Perfect Camera Settings will help you to get off of automatic mode and explore the possibilities your camera offers. Remember, mastering photography settings is a journey, and this guide is your first step and the perfect resource to guide you towards finding the right settings for your style. So grab your copy today at perfectcamerasettings.com and start your journey to better photos.
Nothing. Everything became easier. I was using a Canon G12. So I had all the dials. It was what was called an ultra compact. So like I said, it was the edge of what you could do with the compact camera. And then I got a Canon 5D Mark I. And the day after I got it, like hours after I got it, I went to the place I've been wanting to photograph for a long time, Eternity Beach or Helena Beach Cove, and at 4 a.m. and I took a 20-minute photograph, which is something I just couldn't do. That was what I'd been wanting to do, was take longer exposures. And that photo called Eternity Beach was so f***ed up. I bought a broken camera. It was the sensor was scratched. 40% of the pixels were dead, or maybe 30% of the pixels were dead. Horrible picture. And it took me 5 years to fix that image. Like, I didn't release that image until 2017. Because it took that long to figure out how to fix all the problems with it. So my first experience with a full frame camera was it was garbage and I had to return it the next day. But it didn't make things harder. It made things a lot easier because it was the stuff I had been wanting to try to do.
So with the Canon G12 that you had, still had all the manual controls, and this was just, you were using those. Now it was the jump to a DSLR. Essentially, it was the same. It was just in a bigger body.
Bigger body, more capable body, and lenses. The G12 was six lenses.
I remember, this is so stupid. I don't know why I'm bringing this up. This was the Canon G11, I believe, was the only reason why I had an Amazon card for the longest time. Because if you signed up, because I bought it, and then they said, if you sign up for the card, we're going to give you $100 off. And I was just like, that's a no-brainer. Of course I'm going to do that. And it was a fantastic camera. But I completely understand what you're saying about how it has these limitations. And I think there are a lot of people who the G12 compact camera, that's going to be more than enough for them. So what was the one thing that when you were using it, you're just like, I just can't use this anymore. A DSLR is what's going to solve my problem.
I couldn't take a photograph that was longer than 30 seconds.
So it was the exposure. It was the exposure times that you were looking for. Okay. Yeah. I gotcha.
And the fixed lens held you back a lot.
Right. Okay. So when you got these cameras, right, you're in the military, you're in Alaska. What was like, where were you learning photography from?
I wasn't, it was just trial and error. But when I was in, so my first camera was a SD700. Oh, I can't believe I remember this. It was a Canon SD700, which was just a point and shoot, right, with a few features on it. So there was nothing for me to learn. It was just take the picture and then edit it afterward. And we were just talking, I don't know if it's before this thing started or if we're just going to start the podcast where we started talking about outsourcing. And that was my first experience outsourcing, because stitching those photos together, I used to send them to someone who worked for my dad in the Philippines, and then she would stitch them all together for me. Because I guess the first roadblock I ran into is I would try to use the function in the camera to stitch them together to create that panoramic, and it would never really work. So then I would take the pictures individually and then send them off. I didn't look at any education in photography for years, which is pretty stupid. But now that I think about it, I don't. I know you said, you know, just read the manual. There's so much in there. But yeah, maybe it's not stupid, but it was just trial and error. Mm-hmm. And then me applying, I guess, what I knew about composition at the time, or just my own kind of eye for things.
If you could go back, would you have chosen some sort of photography education? Because, I mean, I look at you today and like, you're here, you're a professional photographer, like you're pretty accomplished. Like, where do you think that plays a role?
Man, getting here sooner. If I started earlier on social media with good images, I could be in a whole different place today. But like when I hit social media with intention was about the time when organic reach stopped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And there's tons of artists out there who were in it before and they exploded with their reach. And, you know, and selling artwork is about getting more eyes on your work. Right. And then some of selling artwork is having that clout that says you have earned all of these eyes. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if I had done all of that stuff sooner, then I could be in a different place, I suppose, or in the same place, but better off. I don't know. Like I'm pretty, if old me looked at where I am now, he'd probably be like, you made it. But I think he just didn't understand what it was to run a business and stuff like that. But yeah, I think just sharpening the curve.
Do you think that you would still be able to be the artist that you are today in terms of being able to tell the stories that you see if you didn't have those years of just, I guess, self-exploration?
Yeah. So I have, so the story and the art are two different things.
Yeah.
Like the story is you understanding yourself and being able to digest and then export that stuff. Right. And then the camera skills, it's a whole different thing. I think that it was photography that forced me to do that self-exploration, that personal growth. So maybe if I had gotten started sooner, a lot of things might have been different.
But you could play this game all day. So let's just move on and just forget that past there. I want to learn more about where you are today in your photography, obviously. And as a fine art photographer, I think it's always interesting talking with fine art photographers because I think with listeners of the podcast, there's kind of this confusion, I suppose, of exactly what fine art is. So before we kind of get into some of your art and how it is that you see the world, can you tell us what is fine art and what makes it different than snapshots or just regular art, I suppose?
Context. I think art equals creativity plus context. So without context, all you have is creativity or decorations. And context is everything. That's what goes deeper. Like a visual will help an audience get their attention. And then people can ascribe their own story to whatever they see if they want. But most of the time, it stays a surface level engagement.
Yeah.
And then context is what brings people in. And context can be anything. It can be personal. It can be like relative to yourself. Like if you read a lot of the stories on my website that are attached to the pictures, they're not about the pictures. I don't tell stories about how I took a photograph. I tell the story of myself and what I was thinking and what I'm feeling when I'm writing the story, basically. And then the photograph fits the story somehow. And it's that context that brings you in. So it could be context about yourself. It could be context about what's happening in the world today, or greater human relative philosophy. But without the context, you just have a piece of creativity. So I think fine art and art is separated by that context. Piece of the equation.
Jeez, I don't think I've ever heard it described like that. And that that really gets the wheels moving for sure. So we're not talking about intention, because I guess anybody who's shooting in manual shooting with intention. So is the context is a story that we're trying to tell. Mm-hmm. So we already know the story that needs to be told. That's the context. And then it's the tool of the camera that we're using to simply be able to tell that story.
Yeah.
Wow. I love it. So tell me when did this first happen for you? Because you were going out just taking snapshots of bears. And today that's probably what very little of your body of work is comprised of. So when did that switch from snapshots to, or I guess when did that light bulb moment finally go off for you? And you start to switch the way that you shoot so that it does have more context.
It happened on Facebook. Like I actually remember this because it's really important to like my growth. But someone had commented, I think his name was Ben, about the boats that they see in my photos. Because I was taking photos and in all of the compositions, there was a boat like in the distance or somewhere by itself, just one, like a yacht or a sailboat or something. And he was like, he said something about, it's cool. I like seeing all these boats. And I started thinking about it. And that, I think that was like the catalyst for me finding my way into this thing that I call comfortable isolation. And just having that, that solitary object. And then I started looking for that composition and creating that composition, right? And I have a whole Lonely Boat series on my website that's just of the boats, but also the more my images developed. So that was the catalyst. But then 2014, maybe, I started asking myself why I like this and why is it important and why am I composing this way? And that's kind of when the next big leap in me solving my issues, right? Like photography was my therapist, I guess, not in a therapeutic way, but just in a way of forcing me to ask questions. And I started digging deeper into that whole thing.
It's just always fun to hear like the journey that people go through, and I'm there with you. Like when it comes to figuring out something about yourself through your photography, there really isn't much cooler because suddenly your work becomes your own and nobody else can take the same photos that you're taking. And it really is all that experience that you have. But I want to know more about your comfortable isolation series, because this is pretty predominant, you know? So where did this idea come from? What made you realize, oh, wait, I am doing it this way. Why don't I continue to do this? There are two ways to bring home more money with your photography business. You either get more clients or you spend less of the money that you make. CloudSpot Studio helps you keep more of what you earn. With the lowest payment processing fees in the industry, the average photographer will save $300 annually. And that's just more money to invest in essential gear, like a new flash or a sweet camera bag. You know, one that is perfect for storing all of the wedding day snacks that you can pack. But it's not just about savings. CloudSpot Studio is designed to streamline your workflow. Easily organize shoots, send contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and you're really going to enjoy the hassle-free payments. So sign up for a free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com, and as a bonus, you're going to get access to my exclusive wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires at no additional cost. Why let fees chip away at your profits? Empower your photo journey with CloudSpot and watch your business soar.
Oh, man. Okay. So it came from some abuse I experienced as a kid. I was like 7 or 8, and my reaction to it. So I spent my whole adolescence, probably up until I was 22, which I remember when this started ending, angry and unable to make friends and distrusting of my own feelings and thoughts, which is something that still goes on today. Because of the way things played out when I was 7 or 8, I felt like I couldn't trust what I was thinking. So anytime I would have a feeling or have a goal I felt like this is what I want, but is it what I want? Or this is what happened, but did it happen that way? And I just wasn't able to trust it. So I ended up, as I was a kid, just closing into my own little circle. And it sort of developed this thing in psychology called the other. One of my first things I wanted to be growing up was a psychologist. And I don't know why, because it was a psychologist that fucked me up. But this thing called the other, which is sort of like a filter between my experience and my reaction. And some people would say, oh, that's meditation, you choosing your thoughts, but I didn't get to choose. It was just a filter, and it caused me to be angry. Like, I wrote a poem when I was a kid called A Devil State of Mind, and it described me getting angry, going to bed, waking up just as angry, and then spending the day getting angrier. And I would just go in cycles like that, just getting madder and madder. So that forced me to be sort of this isolated person. Right? But then I spent a lot of time in my head, and it's not really such a bad thing. Like at the end of that, you know, getting into 20, 22, 23, 24, that sort of walls became a home, you know, and then it became a place where I could talk to myself. And then as that worked its way into the art, into my awareness, it started working away. So the way I describe comfortable isolation is those conversations with ourselves, that's how we grow, right? In psychology, we don't mature until we confront our beliefs. And nowadays, those discussions with ourselves, those times where you have to sit and really confront what you think and what you believe, is a hard thing to do. It's difficult to have that inner monologue. And it's even more difficult today because we can pick up our phone and distract ourselves. It's like, oh, shit, bad thoughts coming in. I have to do this work. I'm going to text my girlfriend, right? Or I'm going to watch TV or watch a video or go out with the boys or something. And it's really easy to avoid that. So when I started thinking more about it, I want to create spaces where you could have those conversations in your head comfortably, where you could be alone and confront yourself and have that, but be comfortable being alone. And it morphed into me being isolated behind my walls to me embracing it, to me creating those places where you could embrace it.
That's beautiful.
Comfortable isolation.
Yeah. Wow. That's powerful. And that's very beautiful. So in the photos, because I can think of some in my head, I'm sure that we'll have some in the show notes if anybody has any, or they want to get an idea of what your photos from comfortable isolation looks like. So describe to me, like, what elements go into a photo that fit the series comfortable isolation.
So there's two ways to be isolated. You can be in a space with nothing, or you can be in a space with so much that you still feel alone. Mm-hmm. Right? So quietness and cacophony. When I'm creating images like this, what I want to have is a singular subject in a open, soft space. So Edge of Solace is kind of one of my best pieces. Solitude is one of my lonely boats that fits this the most. One of my favorites is a piece called Room for One, but it's called Room for One in Their Dreams. And that's a piece from Bali. It's a hammock in the water, which is also a lonely boat series picture. And then the flip side of that is being in so much detail and noise that you're still alone. And this is how I describe being in New York City. Like you have all of this stuff happening around you, but you're still alone. And people feel alone in big cities, even though there's so much around them, because all of that noise doesn't really matter to you or isn't really part of what's happening. It just surrounds you and envelops you just like nothingness would. So it's high fidelity information, lots of detail all over the place, and edge to edge content. So there's in all of my new work, especially, there is no images that are sort of have a lot of stuff and then a little bit of something else. It's either all information or the isolated thing. And images that I have like that are a Ventosaura, Tree of Fire. I don't have many because those are kind of hard to make that look good. There's a piece called Autumn, which is just leaves, just dozens of leaves edge to edge.
Okay. So this idea of isolation, if we were to go to therapy and a therapist were to say, close your eyes and think of a quiet and like a serene place, I think we all think of somewhere out in nature, right? And it seems as though most of your work is out in nature. You know, I don't see you going to corporate parties and taking photos. It's all about nature. Is that intentional? Is that for that reason? Because of how it makes us feel inside?
No. Well, nature doesn't argue with you, right? I don't have to tell nature to pose. You just show up and you get what you get. And that's what made, and I think that's what makes a lot of landscape photographers start with landscape, right? There's nothing to confront except nature. So I started with landscapes mostly because I was afraid to take pictures of people.
But bears were okay. Getting nose to nose with a bear, that was cool.
But you don't have a choice. That just happens.
Right? Okay.
Honestly, I was 20 times more scared when I was nose to nose with a moose.
Oh, geez.
Than a bear, right?
I don't want to do either of those things.
Yeah. A moose would kill you for no reason. And then not even eat you. Just stomp on you till it's bored and then leave.
No, thanks.
So yeah, I think that's one of the reasons a lot of people start with landscape photography. And that's why I started. So I have another collection called Aria, which deals a lot with these stories that I've had a lot inside me and the stories of the subject that I'm working with. But those are portraits. And it took me years to get into portraits because I was afraid of them. And that's actually one of the things I'm most proud of is these portraits. But landscapes, I forgot your question again. I'm sorry. I went on a tangent.
I love it. It's all about like why nature, like what is it that does it for you when it comes to nature?
Nothing, zero things has to do with being in nature. It's just being alone. And nature provides a whole lot of subjects that you can take pictures of. and you get to be alone if you want when you go out there. I always see, and this is just like a contention I have, and I try to dissuade all of my students from this narrative where like going out into nature makes me feel connected to nature or whatever, because I think that's BS. What you're trying to do is connect with yourself in some way, and I think you can do that. You don't have to go into nature to do that. Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that all happens in my head. The whole isolation thing that happens in my head. And then I used nature to create those. But as my art sort of grows and I become less stuck in the stringent world of what landscape photography is supposed to be, and start working with more manipulations and composites, it's not entirely necessary for me to create a photo of nature or something like that. Mm-hmm. So like Edge of Solace is a composite. And there's pictures that I've been wanting to create for a long time that are, there's nature included. Like Solitude is a boat floating in a very white scene, right? Fog and on a lake and what have you. What I really want to create is a boat sailing through the clouds.
Mm.
Still nature, right? There's still that, yes, that element and beauty that comes from what's in the natural world, but I want it to look so freaking real. And just like in the clouds. So still the isolation. So there's still the aesthetic that I'm looking for, but not necessarily nature.
Sure. I like that. The nature, natural elements, but it can still be yours. You can still create it, even through a composite. That's very cool to think about. I want to know more about when I go on your website, I can tell just how important printed work is. By the way, shout out to that dog. Whatever dog is going nuts, I hear.
It's my dog. His name's Loki.
Loki? Okay, yeah. Well, yeah. Living up to his name here. So when I go to your website, I can definitely see why, or I can see how important printing is for you and having something physical that you can have. But I guess in a world where people take photos and they just live on their phones, I guess what I want to know is, why is printing so important to you?
Well, I mean, that's kind of how I make money, I guess. It's not finished till it's printed. There's a tangible aspect of having art and being able to experience it. And up until this whole NFT thing that's going on right now, the only way for people to consume art was as a physical piece of whatever. And so the end product of, you know, like I talked about not getting a job and then making money with photography, right? I was taking pictures doesn't make you any money. Mm. Not me anyway. Selling them does. So the print comes from the sale, but having that finished product be as match your intention and the aesthetic you want to create is super important.
Are you selling NFTs? Can you talk to me more about that?
Yeah, it's a major part of my business right now. And making the leap from traditional art to NFTs was a bit of a mind hurdle for me. Mm-hmm. So NFT, if you haven't heard yet, whoever's listening, is a non-fungible token. It is a digital, it signifies ownership of an asset. Mm. And that asset could be a digital image or a physical asset in the real world, a piece of property of some sort. So when you sell an NFT, you're selling ownership as an artist, you're selling ownership of a piece of art. And because it's on blockchain, the ownership of that art is tracked forever. Right. So when someone has the Excalibur sword, right, and it's in a museum, it's like this sword was owned by Prince Egypt of the second Tuesday or last Wednesday, you know, whatever. It's got a whole history. And now as artists, we can have a history of all of our work, which allows us to command a little bit more value from it. And allows people who are buying it to add value and trade it. So NFTs are like digital trading cards. And yeah, they're a big thing there right now. And they're going to continue to be a big thing.
Okay. So a few questions. I'm very new to all of this, so excuse any ignorance that I may have. I often describe to my couples in my contract, it says that I still own the rights to the images. You get the images, right? And the way that I explain it is, you know, if I were to buy a copy of a book, I own the book, but I can't sell that book, right? Like I don't own the words in that book. I just physically own a copy of that book. It's the author who owns that book. It's the same with photography. So with NFTs here, it sounds like once you sell the book, you're selling everything inside of it. Like you're selling the words, you're selling the ideas. Thinking, no, okay,
no. Can you sell that book? Uh-huh. You bought a book. You don't own the intellectual property inside the book, but you own the book, mm-hmm. and you can take it and sell it back to the bookstore.
Sure.
Right. But in the case of a book, there is wear and tear, and it becomes a secondhand thing that mm-hmm. doesn't hold the same physical value because of the time that is spent in a non-pristine condition. With the NFT, you still have a perfectly preserved piece of whatever you bought, in this case, art, and you can go sell it. And because it has a value of some sort, whatever it is attributed to the value, which is you as an artist and its prior trading, its prior sale price, you can command that sales price or higher when you sell it.
So let's take,
you don't own the Mona Lisa, when you don't own the intellectual property of the Mona Lisa, but you can still sell the piece of art if you own it.
So is that also what's going on? So as a photographer, you still own the intellectual property of the photograph, mm-hmm. even after selling it as an NFT?
Yep.
Okay. So
nobody has the rights to, if they buy a piece from me, they don't have the rights to go mass produce it. Mm-hmm. They can only sell the one piece that is the piece that I created and the piece that I sold. And because the history is tracked mm-hmm. all the way back to when I minted it or when I put it on blockchain, the buyer and the market knows that it is my work.
Mm-hmm. And that's authentic. So what sorts of images are selling most as NFTs, I suppose, because I'm not going to be selling, I'm not going to be selling photos of my couples, right? Like
you could, but probably not because you own the property, right? But uh-huh. you're going to find an audience that wants to take pictures of, or that wants to buy pictures of other people's marriages.
Right.
Maybe not. So the thing that held me back from doing portraits in general was that I didn't think I could sell them, because who would want to buy something with someone else's face on? But if you, part of that was just my lack of maturity in art, because if you look at what sells in art in the high end art world, it's portraits, pictures of people, because it's a face that you can attribute and you can put yourself in those shoes and whatever emotions are there. But honestly, what's sold more is my portraits. So I have an angel series that I still working on now that is already sold for this one project. And then what's really cool about NFTs is I get to sell stuff that I never thought I could sell before. Halloween images, like these creative images that I created, fantasy type Halloween stuff. I never spent any time on those in the past because they weren't income generating items. But yeah, so creative portraits, random or generative art, which is art landscape photography, is selling. Shoot, there's a guy named Justin Avers something. He did a whole series called Twin Flames. And those are kind of regular pictures of twins as sets. And they're selling for hundreds of ETH. I think one just sold for like 300 ETH, which is
a lot of money. Yeah.
300 times $4,600. So yeah. It's like over $1 million.
So are people buying them? Are they following, say, you as the artist, or are they searching for certain types of images and they're seeing them and then they purchase them at that point? How does that work?
Right now, personal branding is really, really important in the NFT space. And people are discovering you through social media, through the persona you're creating and then putting out there. And search functions on NFT marketplaces are kind of behind. Like I can't go to OpenSea and type in Blue Wave Portugal and it'll come up with something that is exactly what I'm looking for. A lot of the sales that are coming are from direct marketing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot of organic growth. And yeah.
So for new photographers, like just getting started, looking to start making money with their photography, this is something that maybe it's a few years off. Is this something that?
No, it's tomorrow. You do it tomorrow. Yeah. There's 15-year-olds making hundreds of thousands of selling figure drawings. And there's a series called Long Necks or Neckies. I think she's like a 11-year-old girl, millionaire now, because she created something that lots of people love. And NFTs offer ownership of art to people who never thought or never looked twice at a piece of art. Like, yeah, in marketing, I have this whole thing. People are either not problem aware or actively searching for a solution or ready to buy, right? Mm-hmm. And the NFT space has taken all the people who are not problem aware and shown them that art's a real thing that they can own. And there's so many buyers who are coming in who have, we talked about like maturity in your experience with art, who have none of that. So they're not coming in with any preconceived or cultural education about art. They just see shit they like and then they buy it. Mm-hmm. And it's offering the ability to own stuff, which is why we have anything. That's why anyone collects anything. It doesn't have any value. The Charizard Pokemon card that's like $300,000+ right now doesn't have any real value. It's not going to save your life, but because someone owns it and because other people want to own it, it has value. Mm-hmm. So the NFT market is creating that for artists and exposing a whole lot more people to it. So yeah, if you're a photographer and you're creating something that has art plus context and great visual and all that, then you should be in NFTs yesterday.
Interesting. So where does this put you in terms of, I guess, do you see print going away in the future in lieu of NFTs? Like, are people just going to have TVs in their house constantly rotating their NFTs that they have? Or am I thinking about this all wrong?
I think some people will, because people own them and they want to display them. And I think it's going to force at some point, because still the NFT market is still really small. Like hundreds of millions of dollars have sold this year from NFTs in the last 10 months, but it's still small in a $16 billion art business, art world. And I'm already seeing like people who have bought my work, they have their digital screens up. And some of those people have gone and bought physical stuff from me too. Mm. And so I don't think there's not going to wholly or suddenly replace the physical art market until those screens become better than the physical products for digital products. And if you're a photographer, you're creating a digital product. There's this idea that there's going to be a metaverse or a digital place where we live. And we already live there. Like we spend all our time on our phones and on this digital communication. So we are kind of in a digital world, right? We're just not experiencing it in a three-dimensional way. This is still a two-dimensional interaction. But when that three-dimensional interaction comes and people can have a home in a digital space that has walls, that's where the art's going to go. And all of the art that's sold now, you know, 10, 15 years before that metaverse really, really exists for everybody, you have first mover advantage and you have the provenance of being here and being first out there. So I think it's a big thing.
You've brought to light a lot of things that I've wondered, but have never, I guess, fully understood about NFTs before. So I'm sure that a lot of listeners are going to maybe think twice about NFTs as well and think, oh, maybe I could do something with this. Cause I see what you're saying. It does really sound interesting. And I'm starting to see how the pieces are fitting together for how they can be used in the future with things like, as you're saying, the metaverse, and obviously Facebook came out and said that they're starting a new,
they're going to build, they're going to build it first.
That's an interesting idea. Well, thank you. There's a lot to think about there. I feel like my brain is still spinning. I want to keep talking about your photography, your art, because I know that when it comes to photography, there's a lot of photographers who, what's the quote? We all get into a creative endeavor because we have good taste, right? Everybody has their own version of good taste. And that's why we get into it, because we feel like we would be good at that thing. But then it is our own good taste that tells us that as a beginner, we're like, this is garbage. And then we get out of it. So you have to push through that, which you did. But then at some point, you have to continue to draw inspiration from somewhere else. So for you and your work, where do you draw inspiration from? What keeps you going? Aside from being unemployable, what keeps you going in photography?
There's a challenge to creating what's in your head and doing it well. And like I said, I'm a pretty competitive person. So the challenge of that, like this, that image I described to you earlier, the boat sailing through the sky, I want to do it in such a way that it makes you feel like it's real, because it's just a digital version and you can just create a digital piece of art and call it a boat in the sky and whatnot. But there's, you know, that whatever pizzazz that I have with my work that I want to create in that type of visual. So I guess having ideas is what keeps me going. And there are definitely times when I don't have ideas, And you just, then the business of art just kind of keeps me going, right? Because that's a constant endeavor. But then you have ideas and you feel inspired, like with this angel collection I'm doing. So yeah, so collaborations, you know, getting into other projects and helping other people achieve certain visions also is a major motivator for me. And the artist selling art is another one. Because now one of the things that keeps me going is I have to keep performing to kind of maintain my position as a teacher. So I got to keep staying on the game and seeing and helping all those artists with their businesses and helping them succeed is also kind of like rewarding in a way that keeps me going. So it's no single one thing. I think the biggest driver is the challenge of just trying to create something that people like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a difficult thing, right? We play that game in our head of, well, I like this idea, but will everybody else like it? And if not, what does that say about me and my work at that point? That's cool. I got one last question for you here. And that is, this is a new question that I have for this year. The theme of this year is really just I'm trying to kickstart people to actually go out and take photos, right? There are people who, I can't tell you how many people just listen to this podcast and then they don't go out and take photos. And I hope that they're listening right now, right? And it's my job to compel them to go out and actually take a photo. So learning about your process a little bit is something that is important to me. So for your creative process, would you rather, so you have an idea for a photo, right? For your creative process, would you rather go out and take 1,000 photos, or would you rather go out and find that you only have one space for one more photo on that memory card and live within that constraint of only being able to take that one photo to get the perfect shot?
I think there's a lot of creativity in restriction, or creativity in constraints, to use that term. And that's one of the excuses I would tell myself or justify myself for not buying more lenses. Because this is the lens I have. This is the constraint I live in. I have to make it work and force the creative part to take over from the assortment of possibilities for technical use. So having one photo left would force me to take more time to create that photo, right? Mm-hmm. And I already said I only take a few photos at a time. So yeah, option B.
I love it. Jason, again, man, I have to say thank you for coming on and sharing everything that you did today. Before I let you go, where can listeners find out more about you, your work, and what it is that you do online?
So my website is jasonmatias.com. And then on social, I'm Real Jason Matias on Twitter and Facebook.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with a friend. Start a conversation. Grow together. That is it for this week. Remember, the more that you shoot today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.